Everyone, welcome to Manufacturing Hub. This is episode 155. It's a little bit different today for all of our longtime listeners. I am not with Vlad. Vlad is in London on another adventure today. He may be in the comments at some point later, but it is Dave as solo on Manufacturing Hub. So everyone, welcome to Manufacturing Hub. I am Dave. If you guys have been here before, welcome back. If it's your first time here, welcome. If it's your first time here, we do our very best to have an open, fun, educational show over the course of the next 60 to 75 minutes. This month, we're talking all about consumer packaged goods. Every week, we've picked a different topic. We've done food and beverage with Vlad and I. We've done quality and compliance and cosmetics and beauty, which was a wild conversation. And I don't know if it makes me want to never use another like non-branded or off-branded facial product ever again. We talked all about co-packers, and this week we are talking about sustainability. So if you guys are watching live, our main channel is LinkedIn on my profile, which most of you guys are. Please go ahead and feel free to say hi, drop comments. We will do our very best if chat is cooperating, as it does about, I don't know, one of every two times that we do one of these shows, to go ahead and pull those questions in live and go show them. If we don't get a chance to go do those, I'll do my best to go get on LinkedIn to go have your questions come in, and we'll chat with Paul about them. And failing all of that, or if you guys have like super technical or specific questions, we'll do our best to get back and go answer those. I see someone on LinkedIn saying hello. Thank you. I don't see you on Restream, but seeing that makes me feel like there's a high probability we're going to get some of these questions coming to Restream today. So thank you very much for that. Without further ado, everyone, officially welcome to Manufacturing Hub. This is episode 155. My name is Dave, and today we've got Paul Bennison on. Paul, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. And that's how I'd like to start, by basically thanking Dave and the Manufacturing Hub for inviting me to the call. And I look forward to today basically sharing with today's listeners a little of my professional background and some of my ongoing projects with a sustainability component. Hope the audience finds information informative and beneficial to your ongoing projects. So let me give you what I like to call the short Cliff Notes version of how I got into the automation field. So as I sit today, I've spent 25 plus years, effectively my entire working career, in the industrial automation space. I've worked with industrial manufacturers to help them automate their discrete process and hybrid manufacturing production facilities. And I've worked with clients and projects in Europe, Asia, but mostly here in the US. As you could probably tell from my accent, I grew up in England. I was the son of an engineer, and with a strong, a joke about this, but with a strong parental encouragement, I was, you know, to follow him in his footsteps. Thankfully, I was good at math and science, and with the help of grants and scholarships, I was able to achieve a Bachelor of Engineering's honors degree in agricultural mechanical engineering, and more interestingly, a master's degree in advanced manufacturing with a robotics minor. And upon graduating, I joined Texas Instruments Industrial Division, and I moved to their European headquarters located in Nice in the south of France. Subsequently, the ISD division of TI was sold to Siemens. I moved to the US in the 90s, and I worked for both Siemens, Schneider Electric, Modicon. Early in my career, it's interesting, my role really focused on product management, marketing, and had the good fortune to work with some great people and industry initiatives that really impacted our industry. As an example to that, I worked with Dick Morley at the barn when he was doing some of the early industrial Internet of Things. Worked with Dennis Brandle with his ISA S88 batch standard. I worked with Mark Fondel with his Transparent Factory Industrial Ethernet initiative. And last and not least, Andy Swales, the inventor of Modbus TCP, the protocol. And I've enjoyed engaging with customers to determine their needs and production challenges. And effectively, I moved into the Siemens Sales Division and really the science of consultative selling several years ago. And for the past 3 years, I've been a corporate account manager working for our global food and beverage CPG sales team, really with a US regional focus. And I'm assigned to several global key accounts with an F&B focus. Sustainability of these companies are a key component of their corporate initiatives. And I'm currently involved in multiple ongoing projects, engagements, with a sustainability ROI component. And I'm going to share some of that with you guys today. So back to you, Dave.
No, thank you so much. Thank you so much for that, Paul. I think it's really interesting. I see a couple of people say they can't quite see us yet on LinkedIn, which they probably can't hear me say they can't see DS quite yet on LinkedIn either, but I can see a couple of people. So we'll give that a minute and see. I will continue to monitor that as we are going through. But Paul, I want to go have the conversation about kind of your background. Yeah. You've had the opportunity to work in a number of parts, a number of areas across the world. Can you maybe dig into that a little bit and talk about some of the similarities and differences that you see from the European groups you work with versus what with the more North American and American groups that you've been working with the last few years?
Yeah, I think really when it comes to automation, I think the role of standards is a super important common component, particularly with industrial communication standards and methodologies for integrating between IT and OT. So I think that's an important part. I mentioned earlier of the ISA's initiatives. They've done some very industry-leading approaches. S88, 99, 95 are three that spring to mind. What's interesting and what I've seen working with large European as well as Asian, as well as North American and South American companies is they really do value the US's ISA initiatives and standards. So I see that from an automation perspective, really a good way of defining data structures or defining industries and segment and the ability to break down and to look at a manufacturing facility or a batch process facility or a discrete manufacturing facility. Having these, let's go back to S88. It was introduced as terminology and naming conventions. So we could all effectively understand when we talked about a batch or a unit operation, we all really understood effectively what that specifically meant in terms of defining user requirement specs for application code. So I think standards like that are important. What I also see, and we see that also too, regionally across the world, communication standards are super important. And as we know, we've got the Ethernet standards, Modbus TCP, as I mentioned earlier, you've got Profinet, and then obviously Ethernet IP are well-known protocols for vendors. But at the same time too, I look at initiatives around which one I'm particularly interested in is the OPC UA initiative. Yeah, I think when we adopt standards, it helps. Switching over to the electrical world, that's a little different. Here in North America, we have the ANSI/NEMA standards. In Europe, we have IEC. And then across the rest of the world, we have different standards. In particular, you've got the UK standard, you've got the Indian standard. So I think what I see in my interactions on a pretty well weekly basis with these large global corporate accounts I work with is the role of standards are imperative and appropriate for them as they look to try to standardize and bring best practices across the manufacturing operations globally. In fact, I got a number of folks heading down to Miami. I think it's Miami next week at the big cybersecurity conference. And there again, cybersecurity is another great comment or a great topic. It's in everybody's interest to understand a defense in depth and ensure that our operations are secure and protected and in good shape. So that I think that to me is a summary of what I see from global customers looking to standardize across the different regions of the world. Thanks, Dave.
Absolutely. No, thank you for that, Paul. And if you guys can't see us a lot, or if you can hear us on LinkedIn, I'm going and posting people towards YouTube, because for whatever reason, I've seen there are a number of people seeing us still in the pre-live. For all of our listeners at home, if you can hear us and can't see us or having troubles, please go ahead and try that. But no, Paul, I think that's important. And I agree. Cybersecurity is one of those topics that we get to spend a fair amount of time talking about here on Manufacturing Hub. For us, every October is ICS Cybersecurity Month. I think it's really important. And I'm glad you brought it up because I think it's very similar to the sustainability topic that we're here talking about, because it's really easy to say we care about cybersecurity, just like it's very easy to say we care about sustainability. But there's a difference between saying things and actually having the actions of those things. And one of the things that I appreciate is the fact that we're seeing more and more groups investing and spending the time and the money and the energy in topics that include both cybersecurity and sustainability. But I know that I guess from your perspective, can you give us a bit of overview of what CPG products are, how you look at them, what you see the market as?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think for me, I consider consumer packaged goods, CPG as we call them, really they're items that are used daily by average consumers that require replacement, replenishment. Oh, sorry, it's my phone. Yeah, and they include products such as food, beverages, clothing, you mentioned earlier, cosmetics, and household products. And CPG generally have short lifespans, and they're intended to be used quickly. And as the name implies, CPG are traditionally packaged in easily recognizable packaging that consumers can quickly identify. And what's interesting, and so really that to me is really the product space. But it's also interesting, in recent years, CPG manufacturers have made sustainability a key differentiator as they market their product. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at some of the interesting industry statistics. As we were talking earlier this week, in a recent Nielsen IQ in collaboration with McKinsey study, they looked at 5-year of US sales data from 2017 to June 2022. The data covered 600,000 individual product SKUs, representing $400 million in annual retail sales. And these products came from 44,000 brands across 32 food, beverage, personal care, household categories. And what's interesting about this study and report, the product marketing around environmental, social, governance, as we call it, ESG, basically they claimed an average of 28% cumulative growth over the past 4 years by basically emphasizing these sort of ESG sustainable examples or these claims. And to give some example to that, looking at these products, sustainable packaging was one common element where they used the term plastic free or biodegradable. There was environmental sustainability where it was compostable or eco-friendly. And then obviously animal welfare. So it was cage free or cruelty free, not tested on animals. Mm-hmm. That to me, I think, is a good summary of CPG. But also what's interesting is the diversity of products. But then at the same time, too, this move, this 28% cumulative growth, where they're emphasizing these sort of ESG sustainability value propositions. Back to you, Dave.
Absolutely. No, I agree. I think all of those are really interesting. And so I want to dig into a series of these impacts in a variety of different ways. And as we've talked, we've got a list talking about supply chain and sustainable products and production and sustainable retail. Can we start with supply chain? Because I know many people, 3-4 years ago, who maybe have never uttered the word supply chain, started talking about supply chain an awful lot when we were having all of these issues. So can you tell us a little bit more about sustainable supply chain and what you're seeing?
Yeah, I'll certainly do that. And just to let you know, I'll just give what I perceive to be as a good overview of the key leverage points. I've got some great examples that I'll cover later in our conversation and discussion. But really and truly, when we think about sustainability on the supply chain, it's really pressure on suppliers to decarbonize, which will increase further. I will put another way, it's going to increase further as more and more retailers and supermarkets seek to provide future sustainable options. So really and truly, retailers, customers, consumers pushing for that. And it's specifically true for product categories with what I like to refer to as a high greenhouse gas footprint that's hard to abate. We're seeing it time and again with meat and dairy. So I think that's the sort of pressures we're seeing on that supply chain. But then if we start to break that down and we start to look at logistics, warehousing, delivery, we're seeing all sorts of other moves. For example, many of the leading beverage companies to electrify the logistics fleet. They're looking to leverage software to optimize routes and optimize energy consumption, optimized waste and heat, electrification. And then summary it all for food and beverage, it's heat and cold usage in warehouses. So that, I think, is an area, an aspect that is clearly part of this supply chain. But then moving further on that supply chain, we're looking at source traceability, responsibly produced ingredients and circular materials. So paying attention to sustainability in sourcing decisions and leveraging innovative traceability. So I'll give an example to that. A global carbonated drinks manufacturer is moving to what we call rPET for bottles, which is reusable PET. And then last and not least, managing responsibilities of sourcing and supplier transparency. Again, gaining insight, not only to your own internal systems, but establish traceable systems to basically provide retailers and consumers with full transparency. So I think that's a good summary of looking at the key lever points that basically would support a sustainable supply chain concept. So back to you, Dave.
Absolutely, Paul. I would agree. And I think those are good points. Yeah. And you listed a number of different opportunities, yeah, starting with decarbonization and getting more into some specific categories. Yeah. Do you see in the near future we're going to see all of those levers being pulled? Do you think a couple of those levers are going to be pulled soon and we'll see some of the other levers being pulled into the future? What are your thoughts and feelings as you're talking?
Again, so I look after a handful of large global, I'm part of a global team that works with these large global manufacturers. What I'm seeing is, and it's interesting, it really comes from the how they've presented to the public, if they're publicly traded, their position around sustainability. But what's also interesting, a lot of what we're seeing is actually being tied back to C-level executive compensation plans. And when I read a yearly annual report or a sustainability report, they are really emphasizing that these are goals that they want to attain and achieve. And obviously I'm in the food and beverage space. And so this whole supply chain is quite critical to their positioning and to their long-term value add for their shareholders. So going back to, I think, energy consumption, I think I've referred to it as energy consumption and energy measurement. Because as with all things that start off, the cornerstone for all of these discussions is really automation platforms and data.
Okay.
And if you don't have the data, how can you have actionable intelligence? If you don't have the information, then it's just guesswork. I think I'm working on a number of projects where we're looking at refrigeration or storage. I'm looking at logistics, mm-hmm, where we want to maintain integrity. If you're going to load meat products into a truck and transport it 500 miles, I want to make sure that environment was maintained at the right temperature, humidity, so that, again, we've got that custody, traceability, transparency. But I think what I'm seeing is there's genuine initiatives across these sustainable categories. So, yeah, I think that they talk a good story, and it's basically it's actionable investments to basically achieve those goals. But as we were saying earlier this week, one thing that, I'm working with an investor community right now, they love the idea of green, but they like the idea of green, where, yes, we'll do what's right for the environment. We're all going to be good stewards of the planet and being responsible manufacturers. But if we lose sight of making money as part of the goals of the business, then it may well play second fiddle to a more important and prioritized investment project or incentive. I think that's my thoughts on that, Dave.
Absolutely. I like that, Paul, and I like your comment of green. We will absolutely go ahead and get into that. I do want to make a comment. We've got a bunch of people who are watching us on YouTube. Yeah. If you guys are on the Manufacturing Hub YouTube for the first time, thank you guys for joining here. If you guys are watching on the inevitable LinkedIn rerun that will probably come out this weekend because LinkedIn has decided that we're not playing live, don't worry. Paul and I will be in the comments at some point later to go ahead and answer any questions that you guys might have. So Melissa is in the comments saying, Paul, are CPGs requiring their suppliers to report on their sustainability initiatives? That's a good question. Thank you for that, Melissa.
For the accounts that I'm working with, absolutely. They're requesting that that's actually an interesting point. What is the metric? What is the protocol that they're using to measure these savings and achieving those goals? But absolutely, we talk about that circular economy, that they are reaching out. And actually, as I work for a manufacturer, We have reports and studies that basically can be leveraged by, for example, somebody buying one of our PLC systems and using it within their production plant. Yes, people are doing that. Thanks, Dave.
Absolutely. No, thank you for that, Paul. And Melissa, thank you so much for your comments. Again, if you guys are watching on YouTube for the first time, please feel free to go ahead and drop the comments in there. We absolutely can see YouTube comments, even if LinkedIn is being uncooperative. So with that, Paul, and I know you talked a bit about sustainable products. Can we get you to continue down your thought of sustainable products and sustainable production? Because I think that they're very good points.
Yeah. Again, I'll give the high notes on what to perceive are some of the key levers that we need to pay attention to. But at the same time, too, we'll get into my examples later. But yeah, back to sustainable products. Yeah. The real goal here is to develop innovative food and beverage products to drive sustainability. And how do they do that? We're looking for increased product transparency. We just mentioned that a moment ago. But really transparency and traceability from the farm to fork. I'm working with a big Iowa beef producer, and that's going to be absolutely critical to the way they market their high-end food. We're also looking at decarbonizing product life cycles by optimizing product development for decarbonization around raw materials ingredients. Back to that last question, where we're demonstrating, showing we're changing in our manufacturing process, looking at moving to other raw materials or ingredients that have a lower metric calculation supporting what the consumer's requirement. We've got other situations, which I think is interesting, where I've got a global food company I'm working with. They've acquired a new food plant-based meat manufacturer with the whole idea saying there's less. It's meat is going to have that taste. Mm-hmm. I'll leave that to the individual. But seriously, it's going to use less energy being plant-based meat versus with grass-fed raised meat. The optimized packaging recyclability I mentioned earlier, designing packaging for easy recycling. I'm working with a global CPG company that's teaming with a reusable packaging company called Loop. You can check that out. Very interesting. And then again, optimizing material usage, minimizing waste and weight while maximizing recycled material. And I think I gave an example earlier. I'm working with a global soft drinks manufacturer where they're introducing plastic bottles, which are 100% recycled PET bottles. So I think when we look at sustainable products, I think they are elements that basically we need to pay attention to.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was going to say, absolutely. I like that a lot, Paul.
Yeah.
All of those comments, all of those thoughts. Yeah. For me as a consumer, one of the most frustrating things is you get a package of something and then you've got to cut through 10 layers of that packaging. Yeah. And it wasn't all that many years ago that was very normal of you need like a pair of scissors and a pry bar in order to get a piece of electronics out of a package 10 times the size. So I am happy to see both for the sustainability and for ease of recyclability, and just so that people send consumers less garbage, so that we throw less garbage out, that we are continuing to see a trend in that direction.
Yeah, exactly. And then moving on from the product to how the product was produced with sustainable production, here the goal is really to optimize processes, infrastructure for sustainability. I think one of the big things is looking at the energy that's used to produce a product. Yeah. And more importantly, tying that to a decreased CO2 footprint in production. We're looking for CO2 transparency. We want to monitor and track along the production process, improved energy consumption and efficiency with waste heat recovery and load management. We're looking at things like transparency of energy consumption, and most importantly, load peaks, on-site renewables, on-site CO2, or put another way, on-site reduced CO2 power generation. We move away from a diesel gen set to a battery storage system, for example. Admittedly, it's going to get energy from somewhere. The electrical grid, we'll leave it at that. I'm looking at process electrification, looking at heat electrification with reliable power supply. And then last but not least, and I'll put it out there, a digital twin. Looking at sustainable design of the product and production. I think that's a key element. Of the production approach. And then if I look at we're reducing production waste and water usage, because in food and beverage, that's a big deal. And as we all know, we're challenged with water. I think a number of parts of the US is in a drought situation and scenario today. Mm-hmm. In particular, I'm looking at the conditions in Texas in the long term for water and basically raising animals and crops. So let's look at resource efficiency. What can we do to optimize resources use and increase, and again, increase asset lifetimes? What can we do to reduce waste? If we have to have unavoidable waste, so let's say, for example, it's methane that's coming from water, wastewater. How can I use that energy for on-site generation? I'm working with a number of meat producers at this time where they do methane capture on the water treatment lagoons. They gas scrub and they basically provide that fuel basically into a natural gas genset. Flexible production. The whole idea of designing modular plants for quick reconfiguration and sustainable operations. I'll give an example of that. We work with a number of leading edge EPC firms to accelerate the sort of value proposition. And we're doing it through looking at a digital twin in and around that FEL2, FEL3, which is the preliminary design and the basic design of these facilities. With these sort of tools and these approaches, we can look at that type of KPI and then tie that back to a sustainable production metric. In maybe in this case, it's reduced production waste and water usage. Thanks, Dave.
Absolutely. I think that those are great examples, Paul. Yeah. You mentioned digital twin, and I'm going to tell everyone that we're going to come back to that because we've got a couple of like really exciting examples that we're going to get to. But I want to touch on the resource efficiency and the energy management and those topics that you brought up. When you're having conversations with these groups, are these some of kind of the hot button issues that are important to executives, that are important to the decision makers of we need to go hit whatever resource management, energy management, flexible productions, metrics, because it's important to the organization as part of sustainability or as part of other initiatives that they're doing?
I think first of all, when we look, it's really the utility consumption of the facility. And back in my old days, we used to call those wages, water, air, gas, electricity, steam. So let's just focus on the electrical component. And as we all know, I live in North Carolina. I've actually got a very nice investor-owned utility that's got reasonable rates, time of use rates or demand charge rates. But these are going to change. We're seeing it in California. We're seeing it in utility rates will change. And ultimately, there'll be an emphasis to have an aggressive time of use charge rates, so those peak occasions. So the first thing that I find and see with many of my large end users is, do they have a really good understanding of, let's just put it this way, at the point of common coupling for their facility, do they understand the 15-minute interval data that the utility gives them? Have they an understanding, or do they make energy measurement at the power distribution substation level or at the feeder level? It could be in most of these facilities, it's low voltage, 480 volts. But do they have that ability to measure? And if they don't, because typically what I see with most of the main incoming breakers, historically, they've been thermal mag, which is a rather unsophisticated method of tripping on high current. But the idea of using an electronic trip unit with ability to measure KW or KVAR or deploying an energy device is important. The other thing, too, is what I'm seeing. I just did a very nice project for a bourbon manufacturer. Unfortunately, it was in Kentucky, so you can't buy at the distilleries. It's cheaper to buy at the local supermarket. But they were interested in basically looking at the chiller operation, which contained, I think it's 16 to 20 very large horsepower VFDs, and they wanted to energy disaggregate. They didn't have energy metering within the construct of the VFD device. And so we came in with a retrofit solution with split core, et cetera, to basically allow us to get to a 1% measurement. And now I've got the ability to what we call energy disaggregate. So I can now start putting a number to an area in the facility and move forward. And I think back to your point about executives and who's driving this, an operations team at the facility, it may not be corporate engineering, corporate or support, but it really come down to the operations folks who basically have incentives to basically have a better understanding and handle of their consumption. That's one example of, I think. Thanks, Dave.
Absolutely. I think that's a fantastic example. And I think we could go through all of those in detail. Yeah. But I want to move the conversation along to a part that I'm really excited about. So I want to let everyone know that as we were preparing to get Paul on the show, talked to a number of different Siemens people, and everyone has Paul told you about this crazy stuff that he's doing with beef production, as he told you about, like the digital twin for the next generation of the cattle industry. And I think that's basically been everyone's immediate feedback when I told them that you were coming on the show, Paul. Can you give our listeners maybe a bit of an overview and some of the excitement of what you're doing?
Thank you for that. And I'm a passionate fellow, even 30 years plus into this industry. But yeah, so my first project I want to talk about, it really addresses what we discussed a little bit earlier, supply chain sustainability. Yep. So just to give you some sort of interesting facts I pulled up and ready for today's call. If you look at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, they've released a new estimate that livestock produces 11.1% of global greenhouse emissions. Here's another interesting one. Late last year, the Irish Department of Agriculture proposed to kill 200,000 cows to combat climate change and meet their EU climate objectives. Some supporters of this proposal liken farms to factories. And similarly, the Dutch government is also considering a plan to reduce nitrogen pollution caused by manure from 100 million animals on the country's farms. And if we turn our attention back here to the US, in 2018, approximately 25 million cattle for beef were sent to abattoirs for feedlots. And so it's really interesting. Unfortunately, these rather cute critters have got a bullseye, no pun intended, you know, over their existence and being. As I like to call, there's a beef industry call to action. What can we do to really move forward with using automation, using intelligence, and some of the best practices that need to be leveraged today to address some of these issues? So for us, we look at supply chain. We said, how can we use smart herd management and automation to shift the animal feed regime? And this is really interesting. From generic days on feed, effectively to days required to achieve a production specification. I don't know if you're aware of this. Animals arrive at the feedlot. And basically, we said, we're going to feed them for 200 days. And basically, we feed them. And 200 days later, we choose to ship them off unless there's been some kind of health concern or issue. So when you step back and you think about this, it's actually quite interesting. By bringing animals to specification or identifying non-performers early, feedlots can optimize their resources, reduce emission. Younger animals produce less methane consume less food and water per animal. If an animal meets specification 20% earlier, you avoid the most emissions and resource intensive period of its life. So that could be an interesting angle. Think about that. Instead of days on feed, let's actually look to move to specification. How does Siemens propose to do this? We're using what we call our accelerator program. It's an ecosystem partnering program. And right now I'm collaborating with an Australian smart meat eating quality sensor manufacturer. And these guys, you love this, have developed an ultrasound sensor specific for the task of assessing cattle in feedlots. The sensor works by combining AI machine learning models and algorithms to be able to measure and predict the intermuscular marbling and other key meat quality metrics of live cattle as they enter the feedlot. So here we've got a tool now that we can basically, it's really, if we think about it, it's ultrasound, which we'll look for to see our unborn children. But effectively, we're now looking at it to basically measure and see how this animal can behave, or it will finish, as they refer to it in the industry. So using this sort of Siemens, and again, what's interesting, using our outdoor automation rated products and really an edge computing, because that's effectively what it is. It's a mobile device that sits out there where the animals are incoming. We're able to provide really actionable intelligence. And we what's nice is, how can we use this information? So here's an example. A truck of animals arrives. Immediately, we basically take a measurement. We can basically identify almost as soon as the animal arrives, non-performers. And also too, we may have cattle that's already reached a specification need. So that could be quite interesting. In the short-term view, we can be looking at the feed regime from moving from generic days on feed basically to achieving specification, which will be based around, let's just call it what it is, prime select choice, which are the different meat quality grades. Longer term, we can look at reducing feed and water while still achieving the same animal specifications, therefore reducing the volume of resources required. And then longer term, And this is where it gets really quite interesting. And this is where information management and really AI, machine learning, and really traceability come in. We can identify genetics, genetically suited cattle for the feedlot environment to approved were health, eating quality, and time on feed. Because as I mentioned earlier, the bigger the animal, as you can imagine, the bigger those country pies that it drops each and every day. And the fact that the gassier the animal is, and obviously they get thirstier as they get bigger. So here's a great opportunity where now we can provide tools to imagine 25 million animals on a 200-day feed regime. Now we can basically measuring them and actually making key decisions about sending animals to the next phase of the meat packing process, but in a way where I can now basically calculate and basically reduce water, reduce feed, and basically optimize the production of that unit of protein effectively. So that was one example.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. You mentioned the Siemens Accelerator Program. I do want to shout out the Siemens Accelerator Program. I think it's a super interesting program. Paul, I feel like I know 2.5% of everything that it is. But we have had Dr. Gerhard Kress, Vice President of the Siemens Accelerator Program, on Manufacturing Hub. He is episode 144, where we were live at SPS. He is the third segment. If you guys want to listen to more of that for all of the folks at home, really super interesting, really doing some interesting kind of applications when it comes to that. And so I know you're describing some of the things that you've been able to do. Can you maybe share a little bit more of some of the results that you've seen by going through the process of trying to create these cattle to specification as opposed to number of days? Have you gone through that process long enough to perhaps share some of those results?
Oh, yeah. I've got a whole report, and I'll share it with you, Dave, that you can share with your listeners. But absolutely, a little tongue-in-cheek here. Put it this way, we've got statistics. I was going to say there's lies and damn statistics, but seriously, aggregated and been able to demonstrate what happens when if 200 cattle are delivered on day one, and then we basically, and we do that comparison, you can, there's clearly a measured and valid savings around greenhouse gas reduction, CO2 reduction, and just consuming, just all of the savings. I've got that report. If you're interested, I can share that with you, Dave.
Absolutely. I'd love to take a look at it. And if we can go put it in the show notes for the listeners, I'm sure that they would. There will at least be a couple of them who are, I'm sure, would be interested to hear that. And Vlad is at the very top of the list of people who will be interested to go ahead and read the report.
I'm with you. So I've got a couple of other projects that are related with the beef production. So my next project, if we want to talk about that, is what we call sustainable production. And this is the one where we've built the digital twin for a new greenfield meat packing plant. And what's interesting about this approach, it really helps the investors and basically encourages early engagement with the EPC firms and general contractors who will effectively design and build the new facility. And I think that's very important. This is all about... It's typically with big projects, it can be, it'll define up front, this is going to be based on a certain budget. But if we get in early enough, there is opportunity to value engineer, and it's iron sharpening iron in terms of coming up with best practices. And I think that's one of the attractive aspects of a digital twin. But let me just go a little bit more into details for that and why it's important. So let's look at the persona of the investor. We can not only simulate the plant layout, the line designs, but what they can do, they can also now look at the facility from a financial and operations perspective. And financially speaking, we can simulate the various production revenue streams that were delivered by the production line equipment. And with that digital twin, we can simulate, we speed up and slow down the lines. Dave, as I showed you earlier this week, how those animals will move through the facility. Mm-hmm. So that's another interesting angle. We can simulate, which I just mentioned, I got a second example from my accelerator sensor supply from Australia. We can actually simulate smart meat quality sensor data. And I said, I'll cover that in my next example. That will indicate basically what we're looking to do is identify borderline carcass grades and then really effectively apply an optimized refrigeration and storage regime for that individual carcass, okay? We can look at the production line and individual OEM production machines and their operating, and this is really interesting, their state models. And we can predict the kilowatt energy consumption for the normally running state, as we were talking before. This can be aggregated to produce a line facility load profile that we can use to assess the utility rates and the opportunity for behind the meter renewables. We typically use this data with our, and for Siemens, we typically will use this energy, this data with our, what we call our energy twin software. And this helps us design and size the behind the meter generation and storage assets for the production campus. And these assets could be solar, battery storage, recip engines, or fuel cells. So more importantly, we can also simulate the use of manual operations. I think I joked with you earlier this week, it's Barney Rubble and Fred Flintstone with a knife in most of these facilities. Mm. Not much has changed since the Romans. Yep. What we can now do with this digital twin software, we can simulate the use of the manual operations, and there's lots of them. And the what-if scenarios for optimal plant throughput and production KPIs. Today, many of the plant processes still require that manual operation, particularly if you've seen fabrication. Mm-hmm. And manual operation insight is helpful during going back to working with the EPC designers as they do the FEL2, FEL3 planning phase of the design. You know, and so that's where I think it comes in real helpful. But then the value of the digital twin, it also continues when the facility's been built. We can use the twin in conjunction with, we refer to it as our Optimize My Plant application, which allows the plant manager to make daily decisions based upon worker availability and the best deployment of resources for maximum daily operation impact. So I think that there's an example of how we're using these tools to basically, first of all, we'd have to build the facility and then find that it was built too big or too small. And we can look at, for me, I think what's most interesting is looking at the OEM equipment, looking and then building up this on the electrical side, this load profile. And then how can you probably heard initiatives around peak shaving or peak shifting. And you need this type of data. Otherwise, either you're going to measure it, energy management, to be able to deliver to that. And I've got a final one if we want to go into it, which is my sustainable production example. And this is actually, again, using how do I facilitate intelligent operations? And this is really by leveraging and bringing what I'd like to refer to as AI machine learning to the packing plant. Because there's a host of, today, I just look at it, and we'll talk about futures later on in this conversation. But for me, I'm just amazed at what we're able to do with lasers and visual processing, three-dimensional cameras, and graphical processing units. But again, here in this case, here on this sustainable production. So I'm working with, again, my Australian smart sensor manufacturer, and we're working with two of their plant sensors. I'll just talk about one right now. And again, we're leveraging the power of edge computing and AI machine learning and algorithms. They're able to measure and predict intermuscular fat and meat grade. I use a smart laser probe and our edge device at the hot box. The hot box is when the animal is basically, that's that first phase of breaking it down into primal cuts, for example. What we're able to do there is we can measure the hot carcass physiology and we can assign a preliminary beef carcass meat grade. And so this is actually interesting because this can help the meat packers operations team to basically make some decisions about that. One of the key benefits is, as we identify this meat marbling grade at the hot box, is really to identify what we call borderline grades. So is it between prime and select, or select and choice? Mm-hmm. And what we've discovered, and this is known as one of those sort of undocumented but industry tribal knowledge, is these borderline carcasses can be assigned a specific blast chill refrigeration regime, because typically what would happen, animals slaughtered on a Friday, assessed on a Monday, so they've had 2 days of chilling over the weekend, they typically upgrade. Mm-hmm. But the beauty is, if we can identify those animals, we can then basically do a prescribed blast chill refrigeration regime to that half side, and it does upgrade. That's a $200 margin increase for the packer. That's pretty phenomenal when 6% of animals in the facility might be on that borderline. The other thing too is, we can, if we identify the animal as a select meat quality, we don't need to do anything special. We can basically chill to the, so again, I'm making a refrigeration savings, kill the animal and just move it straight out to the sales cooler and out for fabrication. Again, it's like using smart sensors and technology to basically make actionable intelligence at the operations level. And there's a whole host of other benefits the packer can realize from this. We can be looking at pH, we can look at color, we can identify dark cutters. There's a bunch of things that can be done here that could be beneficial. But it all starts off with having data that they never had in the past. And it's data coming, it's not a 4 to 20 milliamp analog signal or a 1 to 10 volt DC input. No, it's actually, you know, laser feedback going through some really high-end computing that's then tying that to a machine learning AI model and basically spitting out information that we've never had in the past. So I think that's very interesting. And just as a final piece, as we were discussing earlier this week, when we look at this architecture, I'd encourage your listeners to look at the Procter & Gamble, Jeff Kent. He's an interesting fellow. He did a presentation at the ARC Forum last year, talking about his team's experience and planned rollout of their, what he calls their operational intelligence program. And this program will introduce thousands of machine learning algorithms at the equipment level at 120 sites in 40 countries. So this stuff is real. It's making an impact. And I think the example I just gave you is one small step for man, one big step for mankind, or trotterkind in the beef business.
Absolutely, Paul. I think those are some really interesting examples. I really appreciate you digging into that smart sensor and the AI example on the carcasses and on the grading. Yeah. I thought that it was really interesting, your comment and your point of lots of them that are borderline could go into the blast chiller for a couple of days in order to find an upgrade. But I also think that your comment of depending upon the grade of meat they are, that there is a period of time in which they have to go sit in the chiller before they're able to go out and be sold. And so the more expensive cuts have to go sit there longer. So while you can upgrade some of them, you can pick the ones that you know can just immediately pushed out onto the sales floor. So I think that's very valuable. Hey. And I would imagine, go ahead.
Carry on. I just gave one example. I'll give another. The other thing too is what we can now do is we can do side railing where we put together like carcass types. Because typically when it comes to fabrication, they'll try and roll out, they call it a chain, the chain will basically contain a section of sides of a meat quality. Okay. And then as they do the changes in the fabrication space, they have to run the whole chain out from the old to basically make sure that they're not combining the two meat types. Well, you can imagine in fabrication, you've got several hundreds of people wait for that chain to basically transition and transfer out. If I can now at the hot box decide that these animals are going to be of a light carcass type, I can side rail, which now means a change in the way we do material handling in the facility. And basically I can group like types together. So again, it's savings. There's less change run out times. And there's just lots of opportunities to save energy and to basically maximize human labor and or automation as it's appropriate to bring into play. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, Paul. And I want to go back to one of your earlier points talking about digital twin and some of the values of digital twin, because longtime listeners will know that I, as Dave, am like absolutely fascinated by digital twin. As I've said, I've designed some facilities in the past that if I were to do it again, I would get rid of reams of engineering graph paper on tables and would just go simulate it because it would save so much time and we could get a one-to-one realistic example as opposed to me sitting there cutting out little squares to try to get a mostly one-to-one iteration of the size of everything. I have been there and we've talked about aerospace applications. We've talked a little bit about automotive applications. We've had Colm Gavin on Siemens on a couple of times and I will have to go dig that up. Yeah. So he was on episode 42 and then he was recently on episode 150. Okay. He's talked a bunch about that and we've had a number of digital twin conversations. But you brought up a really interesting point of there's simulation of these facilities as groups are going out to get investors, as you're going to the EPCs, as you're going to these other organizations, so you can start the optimization before there's money on the table and the money has all been aggregated. And then it's, hey, can we get a little bit of money to do this digital twin? So can you maybe explain what that process looks like? And where everyone sees the value and maybe who is driving the use of the simulation and digital twin so early in the process, please?
No, there's a lot to unpack in there, but I think there's some great points that we need to cover. It all starts off with the customer end user, and then the willingness of really that engineering, the engineering firm, design firm, to have confidence that this is appropriate for what they need to do. But I'll go back to the investors. What I'm seeing on the projects that I've been using this concept and approach with is, most of the time when they're looking at a pro forma or a business plan for a new facility, it's just to your point, it's pages of dead tree spreadsheet, Excel spreadsheet printouts. Now and the digital twin is pretty straight. It can be put together in a matter of, I'd say, a minimal system, 40, 80 hours, we can put a really good system together. Now, obviously, there's a more fidelity need to go in. I'm just being generic here. But the reality is that you can show them, if you can show that investor community exactly how it's not just the physicality of the building shell and what the silhouettes and outlines of the machines will be, but you can start showing them moving mm-hmm. and running. And we can basically, and then the other thing too is it's not just the eye candy of seeing the visual. It's really fascinating when you look at what NVIDIA can do with the graphic mm-hmm. engines, and they go to the industrial metaverse when you compare that to one of Colm's visual simulations of mm-hmm. his facilities. And I totally agree with you. There's wheels and wings. They've got it pretty well down. But looking at these other industries that probably may not have had the appropriate or the mm-hmm. money or even, the inclination to look at this, this is quite refreshing, I think. And the feedback I'm getting from executives at EPC firms and really billion-dollar investment firms is this is the right way to be looking at substantiating, supporting a business. The other thing, too, is we look at the revenue streams of the products mm-hmm. that come through. Give an example. We're not getting too much details, but we can look at, obviously, ribeye mm-hmm. steaks as a prime output of a meat plant is one thing. But then let's take a look at some of the other components that typically may or may not have been of high value. I've got a great one of my investors. He's got he is looking at the reselling of the cattle bones. As he puts it, why do we give one of our man's best friend a plastic bone made in China at $6 when we can get probably a pound of prime meat bones for $6? So it's interesting. So what we can do is we can look at the green comment you mentioned earlier, but also we can look at revenue streams of what other products can we use? And back to the sustainability, if we're going to take an animal's life, and I'm going to challenge your issue with that, let's absolutely maximize 100% of the input into that animal unit and basically do that in a way that is good stewardship of the animal, but also of what we are doing as individuals and consumers. I think that to me is the eye candy is interesting, but more importantly is how it supports the business model. What happens if we don't, again, a lot of these facilities, how do we get thousands of people to come and work at the facility? And then not as COVID really showed that the protein world, the challenges of worker availability or non-availability because of the high reliance of these manual steps. So I think that to me is some of the important aspects. And then last but not least, the fact that I can do an energy summary of the load profile, that's, I think is quite useful in terms of, in particular today, everyone's talking about battery storage, where we see it in vehicles, but look what Tesla did. They took the engine and turned it into the mm-hmm. Powerwall. So I think the digital twin, besides the visualization and then the code generation, which is another critical component, and then the virtual commissioning, and we don't need to get into that right now, but I think the comments that I was making earlier in this sort of early design phase, this FEL2, FEL3 mm-hmm. phase, of preliminary design and basic design and conceptual and preliminary design, it could be very valuable. And to your point, we don't have to mock up or build a prototype. We can do that in that virtual space. So I think that's something for all of us to consider.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. Thank you so much for that, Paul. As we are all ready to mm-hmm. almost the hour mark, but before I ask you the final questions, I always appreciate it when companies and organizations mm-hmm. walk their talk, right? And it's easy to go talk about sustainability. Sustainability in action isn't nearly as easy as we talk about it. And so I know as we were talking, Siemens is doing some interesting things on the sustainability within the organization as Siemens Global. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about that, a little bit about the interesting things that Siemens is doing and some of those results, please?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to do that. We had our own chicken round here, or our own cooking round here. We have a program, we call it Degree, where every degree counts. So really sustainability is a priority for Siemens. And Degree is really an acronym. I'll just give you that. But then I'll talk about some of the aspects. So it's decarbonize, it's ethics, it's governance, it's resources, efficiency, and equity, employability. And first of all, I'm an employee of 25 plus years. It's been a great company with great people, great products, and a great vision of where it'll go from year 175 years and beyond. But really, I think one of the things we're working towards are our net zero operations. I actually worked with our Princeton, New Jersey research facility. Actually, one of my previous projects was working on the microgrid design and working with the local utility. It was it's a very interesting project with solar, battery storage, etc. But we, as a company, we're accelerating our CO2 emission reduction in all of our operations. We've got 120 plus factories. Mm-hmm. Introducing for financial year 25, we're looking to reduce our targets on CO2 by 55%. Mm-hmm. We've got this, and so these are just statistics that the company puts out there. Our CO2 footprint reduction by 46%, or we actually did reduce it from financial year 19 to 22. We've got 37 locations, basically with net zero CO2 emissions, mm-hmm. and we're investing €650 million in operational decarbonization, really from last year through financial year 30. Absolutely. And really, we're looking at our own facilities, which are already built and operating. So using our digital twin concepts, we've come up with an expression where we're going to look to turn brownfields into green factories. So that's really our approach. And we really do eat our own cooking around here.
Absolutely. So absolutely. I appreciate that. We've been able to highlight some of that on the show, and I hope that we are able to go get a little bit more behind some of those scenes later in the year. But Paul, this has been amazing. Let me go ahead and we'll ask you all of the questions that we ask all of our guests.
I like
good. It's my favorite first question. I feel like Vlad rolls his eyes a little bit every time I ask our guests to predict the future. Yeah. But I enjoy having fun with this. So Paul, can you tell us what the future looks like? Maybe predict the future of what sustainability looks like, please.
I think it's really people taking actions on those four sustainability pillars we discussed and deploying them. I think, but to do that, we're going to have to be, again, coming back to the green mm-hmm. concept we talked about earlier, it's got to be affordable and deliverable. And I think it's got to be scalable. And for me, and I step back and look, particularly in my food and beverage, let's look at, I think the whole we talked earlier this week about AI, because I really believe that's going to be the critical component here. There are two winners in the AI space, those who bought NVIDIA stock 18 months ago and still buying it even in January this year. But it's really one of those companies that are deploying AI and machine learning to basically improve their facilities such that they don't make any waste, that they are not using any more energy than they need to. They can scale back their lines if there is a peak consumption rate board, where renewable and where battery storage at a time of peak utility tariff rates of time of use. So I think for me, I think is going to be, how do we put these edge devices on? And it's interesting, the control system will always be the control system. That's going to be the heart of the real-time deterministic orchestrator of the line or the production unit. But what we're going to do is alongside will be this bi-directional platform that's cyber secure at the OT level with northbound, southbound correction, ability to move data. But importantly, is it a CPU or is it a GPU? I think the smart sensors, three-dimensional cameras, and then just getting data sets, data streams from lasers or from whatever new widget that will be invented out there, I think will be the real contributor to a price point and an investment fixed cost to basically provide that return on investment. And ultimately, to spend is time cost value of money. Because as I've shared with you earlier, it's all about making financial benefit for the company employees and the shareholders of the company. Mm-hmm. So that's my thoughts on the future. Hopefully, that resonates. We need to talk after this call about some of those concepts. But I think that, to me, is what is going to make a difference. Thank you.
Absolutely. No, thank you so much for that, Paul. I, I think I generally agree with most of those. And maybe it's some of I agree, some of I hope that we absolutely get to that.
Yeah.
Changing directions a little bit. You have a really interesting career and your education that has brought you into the last 25 years of working with Siemens and these other groups. If someone is starting out, if they're early to mid-career, what is the best career advice that you can go ahead and give them?
I think if you like the micro how it works show and you're passionate, this is a great place to invest your passion into this industrial automation space. I think not all of us need to be programmers. I was looking at one of you and Vlad's earlier comments. A lot of people coming into industrial automation, as long as they've got a good understanding of the mechanical aspects of machinery and production lines and processes. Mm-hmm. I think that to me is having that passion and motivation, and I've maintained that through my career. Then the next thing really comes down to is really never to lose sight of the money trail of how these technologies or systems basically ultimately provide a financial return. So I think having an interest and attraction in automation, I'd even then combine that with like power distribution, because that's a big component that we talk about these days.
Yep.
I think would be, I mean, I think that it's an Oklahoma land rush for those who really want to make a difference. And that's really been my focus is how can we, stewardship of spend, automation systems and system integration and systems can really deliver, can take the human out of jobs that we really don't need to be doing and basically provide a financial return and a repeatability of that application that it makes sense to deploy computers and systems. I think in wrap up to that, having an interest is wonderful. You don't have to be a programmer. I stopped programming several years ago, and that's probably a good thing. The liability of something going awry. But seriously, we're paying attention to how these systems can impact financials. If you like how machines and systems work, I think paying attention to the money trail and how we can basically impact and improve operations, I think would be a good prerequisite of somebody interested in this space and industry. Thank you.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. And I agree that if you can find something you're passionate about and can continue to hold that passion for 20 or 30 more years, it certainly makes going and staying on top of technologies that just continue to change faster and faster. It makes it a lot easier. Yeah. So thank you for that, Paul. I was going to say, do you have a book recommendation for us?
Well, actually, one was recommended. I read, first of all, I love my dead tree, even though I have my Kindle. With my Kindle, I can never remember the title of the book or the page it was on. But I do like my dead tree because I do a lot of flying. But one actually, it was recommended by one of our new heads of sales leadership. But it's a book called, and it's an older book. It's been around since the late 2000s. But it's a book called Energy Leadership. And it's by a renowned coach, as it states, Bruce Schneider. And it really teaches, and I think this is really important, teaches how to understand our most valuable personal resource for all of us. It's our energy. And basically how energy should be harnessed to achieve success in the workplace and the home and in the world at large. And I think focus is attraction. I remind myself very frequently because sometimes curiosity killed the cat. This book is really good at basically helping you identify, look at yourself internally, but at the same time, how do I apply energy? The energy, that God-given energy that you have within your makeup and being, and do and use that in such a way to be a better individual, a good friend, and then basically be successful in the workplace.
So interesting. Yeah. I like that. I have not read that book. I am not sure I've heard of that one as recommended, but it is now certainly on the list.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for that, Paul. Last question for you is, how can our listeners help? Who are you looking to connect with? Who are you looking to talk with? Just generally, how can our listeners help you in what you're doing?
It's 1 + 1 = 3. And I work for a great company, a global leader in software systems and products. That's all to naught if we don't have customer applications or what I really refer to as challenges of their businesses. So really what I'd be interested in is, obviously we've talked a lot about sustainability. And to be honest with you, I'm pretty passionate about sustainability, as you can imagine. But I'd be open to hear of other people's views of what they've thought about our discussion today. But at the same time, too, if they've got an interest or a use case or a challenge that they're seeing that an individual like myself, with the, being around and being involved in industry for 30 and well, in the next few years, there'll be 40 plus years of contributing. Yeah, I'd be happy to work with you, Dave, and with the Hub, and figure out how we might make 1 + 1 = 3.
Absolutely.
So, but I'd like to work with you on that, Dave, and your podcast, and just bringing together the meeting of the minds of customers and producers.
Absolutely, Paul. I think that this has been a really awesome conversation. I think that we've certainly talked about some really interesting and cool applications. And I certainly want to do our very best to continue to keep the listeners up to date on what these applications look like, knowing that there are real people investing not insignificant amounts of money in, and some things will never be as transparent as we as technical folks would love to just be able to showcase all of that. So I completely agree with you. So, but we will absolutely go find a way to continue to do that. And you and I have people in common who are other parts of these, because it is a very small world after all, Paul. But no, Paul, thank you so much for being here. Everyone, thank you for coming and hanging out with Paul and I, episode 155. If you guys are listening on podcast form, or if you guys have watched the replay, because again, we didn't play properly on LinkedIn the first time, so it'll probably go out over this weekend or the next weekend, so you guys can go capture the whole thing live on video to see our smiling faces during this. Please feel free to like and comment and subscribe. Go share with your friend. Go make sure you're connected with Paul, who will be on all of the LinkedIn there. If you guys are doing work similar to Paul, if you want to help us make 1 + 1 = 3, either reach out to Paul or reach out to me. We'll go set up a conversation and see what's happening. Until next week, we will see everyone soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. It's been fun.